numerous essays, Desert Island Decameron. His reading was interrupted by the arrival of a violent electrical storm. Atop the tower, in a flimsy metal shed, Hornig sat alone with the book, the fully armed device, a telephone, and a single light bulb dangling from a wire. He was 25 years old and had recently earned a PhD in chemistry at Harvard. Having designed the X-Unit, he knew better than anyone how easily it could be triggered by static electricity. Whenever he saw a lightning bolt, he'd count the seconds, 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, until he heard the thunder. Some of the lightning felt awfully close. At midnight, the phone rang, and Hornig was told to come down. Hornig did so gladly in the pouring rain. He was the last person to see the device. The test was pushed back to 5:30 in the morning, right before dawn. The rain ended, and the weather cleared. The radio frequency used to announce the final countdown was similar to that of a local station. Thanks to interference, at the moment of detonation, Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings cheerfully played in the control bunker. Kiszczakowski stepped out of the bunker to see the fireball and was knocked to the ground by the blast wave. He was about 6 miles from where the tower had just stood. "This is what the end of the world will look like," he thought. "This is the last thing the last man will see." Viktor Weisskopf saw the flash and felt the heat on his face from a distance of 10 miles. His heart sank. For a moment he thought that his calculations were wrong and the atmosphere was on fire. The hills were bathed in brilliant light, Otto Frisch, a British physicist, observed, as if somebody had turned the sun on with a switch. General Farrell expressed the mixture of fear, awe, pride, and an underlying attraction that this new power inspired. The whole country was lighted by a searing light with the intensity many times that of the midday sun. It was golden, purple, violet, gray, and blue. It lighted every peak, crevasse, and ridge of the nearby mountain range with a clarity and beauty that cannot be described. It was that beauty the great poets dream about, but describe most poorly and inadequately. 30 seconds after, the explosion came first, the air blast pressing hard against the people and things, to be followed almost immediately by the strong, sustained, awesome roar which warned of doomsday, and made us feel that we puny things were blasphemous to dare tamper with the forces heretofore reserved to the Almighty. Kenneth Bainbridge, the supervisor of the test, turned to Oppenheimer and said, "Now we are all sons of bitches." Within minutes, the mushroom cloud reached 8 miles into the sky. The atomic bomb was no longer the stuff of science fiction, and the question now was what to do with it. On September 1, 1939, President Franklin D. Roosevelt had issued a statement condemning the inhuman barbarism of aerial attacks on civilian populations. Nazi Germany had invaded Poland that day, and the Second World War had begun. Aerial bombardment promised to make the trench warfare of the previous World War, long a symbol of cruel, pointless slaughter, seem almost civilized and quaint. In April 1937, the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, had attacked the Spanish city of Guernica, killing a few hundred civilians. 8 months later, the Japanese had bombed and invaded the Chinese city of Nanking, killing many thousands. An era of total war had dawned, and traditional rules of warfare seemed irrelevant. President Roosevelt appealed to the European powers for restraint. The ruthless bombing from the air of civilians in unfortified centers of population, he said, has profoundly shocked the conscience of humanity. Roosevelt's appeal for decency and morality had no effect. The city of Warsaw was soon destroyed by German aircraft and artillery. Then London was attacked from the air. The British retaliated by bombing Berlin. New theories of air power were applied on an unprecedented scale. Unlike tactical strikes aimed at an enemy's military forces, strategic bombing focused on transportation systems and factories, the economic infrastructure necessary for waging war. Strategic assets were usually found in the heart of cities. At first, the British refrained from deliberate attacks on German civilians. The policy of the Royal Air Force, RAF, changed, however, in the fall of 1941. The Luftwaffe had attacked the English cathedral town of Coventry, and most of the RAF bombs aimed at Germany's industrial facilities were missing by a wide mark. The RAF's new target would be something more intangible than rail yards or munitions plants: the morale of the German people. Bombarding residential neighborhoods, it was hoped, would diminish the will to fight. "The immediate aim is therefore twofold," an RAF memo explained, "namely to produce, one, destruction, and two, the fear of death." The RAF Bomber Command, under the direction of Air Marshal Arthur Bomber Harris, unleashed a series of devastating nighttime raids on German cities. During Operation Gomorrah in July 1943, RAF bombs started a fire in Hamburg with hurricane-force winds. The first firestorm ever ignited by aerial bombardment, it killed about 40,000 civilians. American bombers participated in Operation Gomorrah and the subsequent RAF attack on Dresden, where perhaps 20,000 civilians died. But the United States Army Air Forces, USAAF, opposed the British policy of targeting residential areas, known as de-housing. Instead of the RAF's nighttime area bombing, the strategic doctrine of the USAAF called for daytime precision bombing. Relying on the Norden bomb sight, a device that combined a telescope, a mechanical computer, and an autopilot, the USAAF tried to destroy German factories, ports, military bases, and lines of communication. Precision bombing was rarely precise, and the vast majority of bombs still missed their targets. Nevertheless, American air crews risked their lives conducting raids in broad daylight to avoid killing German civilians. In the Pacific War, a different set of rules applied. The Japanese were considered racially inferior, often depicted as monkeys or vermin in American propaganda. The Japanese had attacked the United States without warning,